Okay, so last class was, we were talking about the geometry. How many people got four of the geometry problems right? Okay, none. Three. How many people got two? How many people got one? Okay, I see four ones. Are these, which ones are these? All dog and gopher? Or
dog and gopher.
Yeah. Dog and gopher, dog and gopher, dog and gopher. Were there any other problems people tried that they got reasonably far on, and what happened?
Birthday cake.
You ran out of time. Not the programmer didn't run out of time.
No, I ran out of time.
You ran out of time. Any other ones that people tried? Yeah.
Crisis and rope land.
Yeah. So you think that, okay, so you were working on it and you still did, but so, yeah, okay.
I used as a model the Superman demonstration.
Oh, okay, yeah.
The Superman goes straight from the first point to the second point, but he goes around any obstacles in his way.
Right.
Same sort of thing, except instead of heading straight towards it, the cause of the amount of changes to the tangent.
I see. Okay, so to try to do that. Well, that's a good argument. I would say Superman would be very good in a tug of war. So there is that other connection between the two solids. Any other people try any problems from that that have any experiences one way or another? Okay, yeah.
I'd be interested to know how many people attempted dog and gopher and Java and failed.
How many people tried to, okay, so we had several people tried dog and gopher and Java and failed. And do you know why? Did anybody succeed in Java? Did anybody succeed in doing dog and gopher in Java? No. Did anybody succeed? And that was, when you failed in Java, did you fail both on the UVA judge and the programming challenges judge, or just one?
I tried the programming challenges for an old program that I
didn't
ask the UVA.
Yeah.
And I sent a message to
both people. Yeah, right. But, okay. So, I mean, you're saying that people tried it.
Yeah, I tried it in Java, and I tried a billion different things. And I tried both judges, and just wasn't getting anywhere. And after enough pain, I decided, well, Ms. Rogers, maybe it'll work in C for some unknown reason. I wrote it in C, and it worked the first time.
Okay. that's a little depressing. But that's again, maybe that's why I wrote the book in C. Okay, yeah. I don't know what I can tell you right now. Any other experiences here? I mean, part of it is trying to figure out why, what that. Again, I don't really know what that might be. But what are my moral lessons?
In theory, they're using the same standard for the numbers internally. So, you know, they're using the IEEE standard.
Yeah.
So
it would not shock me if the problem was even something about sort of how the I/O in Java works, or something silly like that, that it outputs something different than just a line feed or something, you know. But that's something to work on. And like I said, if somebody wants a project for the summer to sort of try to do things to make the job better, we can discuss it. Okay, if somebody has nothing to do this summer and wants to spend some time, that's something we can talk about. Okay, so any more about the geometry problem? Okay, so geometry is good. What I'd like to talk about today are sort of the problems in the last chapter, which is an area related to what I would call computational geometry, which are geometric problems related to polygons. That's sort of the difference between, in geometry we're dealing with curves, we're dealing with circles, we're dealing with lines. In computational geometry, so geometry is an area that is an area of mathematics you learned in high school, and these problems were not, you know, the algorithmics of these problems you basically knew how to do in high school as well as you know how to do it now. Computational geometry is an honest area of algorithms, same as graph algorithms or string algorithms, related to problems on geometric points and polygons. So let's take a look at these problems first before we discuss the theory, just to sort of get some sense as to what the problems are. The first problem says that there's this campus which is infested by this undesirable creature, okay, which I think in this particular school are freshmen. And so what they would like to do
is to, so you have a world here where you have freshmen scattered around the lawn. You have what I think is a flagpole or something like that.
What is this? Is there a telephone pole?
And they want, you want to tie a thread around the flagpole, telephone pole, so that it encloses all of these freshmen to keep them away from the rest of the community. Okay? And the question is, how much thread do you need? Okay? You were given, you know, they say that at the ends, I guess they say that you need to leave 1 foot of thread at the end to tie it to the telephone pole. But the basic question is, given a set of points, how do you find how do you find the way to cover all those points using the minimum amount of thread? Okay? Any ideas about that?
Let's take a look at that.
Okay? Any ideas how you might do this? Or any thoughts about this problem? Yeah?
My initial try would be, it becomes really weird if the points are around the pole. I don't know how to handle that. It's a little more difficult. But it seems like one thing you could do, and actually maybe my algorithm will work anyway, is you just find an angle where you're not touching anything, mm-hmm. and start sweeping out until you actually, basically, you probably do that by, from this, find the angles to all of these and sort them. And take the first one. Mm-hmm. And then from there, you do the same thing from this point. Find the angle to all of those and sort them based on this line. And then take the first angle that sweeps out.
Okay.
And then you will end up here. And then you do the same thing from here.
So what it looks like what you want to do is you want to wrap it like it's a package.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a little bit like what you're trying to do, it looks like. Right? If you want to wrap this projector up, what do?
Well, you put the paper on one side and then you roll it along to figure out where the boundary is.
Okay? Yes.
If you had a flash that was very close to the telephone pole, and the first flash was far away, it might be good to stick over the second flash and go right onto the third.
What do you mean by this?
Here, I'll show you.
Let's say we had a flash right over here.
Yeah.
We would still want to use the same path, but this one would be for this in terms of angle. You have to skip over this one. Right. So what you're noticing is that not every point. I will pull this for the sake of geometry. I will pull the points now. Not every point is necessarily gets thread in their face, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because some points are inside the situation, inside the polygon. And some points are not. Okay? So we sort of agree that this is basically a polygon, that the thread is forming a polygon. And you want to know the minimum length perimeter polygon given the, given the points. Okay? Any questions? Now, we agree that one thing that's interesting is the question of whether T is on the inside or T is on the outside. Those do seem sort of like different cases. Why is that? Does anybody see why that might be? What is sort of the difference between this polygon and that polygon?
Convex versus concave.
Right. So we say that a polygon, we'll talk about it, we say that a polygon is convex
if there is always, no matter where you are in the polygon, take two lines in the polygon, points in the polygon, you can draw a line between them, and it's all the way inside. This is convex. This is not necessarily convex. Okay, this is not convex. As you can see, that knot prevents convexity. Okay, and that's going to be interesting because we're going to talk about a little bit about how do you find the convex hull of a polygon. Okay, which is basically the smallest convex region that contains a set of points. Okay. So that I want to claim might be appropriate for this, but this may require a little bit more thought. Okay? I'll have to think about that. Any questions? Okay? So this is that's the problem of that's the first problem.
The second problem is says that you're having a
This organization wants to arrange a dance. And the trouble is that the area where they want to arrange the dance, okay, has trees in it. I think trees that are typically points on a grid. Let's say this is it. And let's say the whole area sits in a box. And the question is, they would like to arrange a dance floor for the people to participate in. And a dance floor is a rectangle. They basically want to know what is the largest area of rectangle they can construct that doesn't contain any trees. Okay. Is that clear?
So for example, for this right,
these particular points, we could have a rectangle here, we could have a rectangle, let's say like that. We could have a rectangle that goes, again, it's probably a little hard to tell, but I would probably say like this. This is where my money would probably be for the largest empty rectangle in the set of points. Okay? Does everybody sort of see what the problem here is?
Problem here is we are given a set of points, and we want to find the boundaries. What is the input? The input tells us basically that in each scenario we've got the length and the width of the area, and then a specification for what the set of trees are, okay, where the trees are described as either points telling you where the trees are, or they will tell you about lines of trees or boxes of trees, okay, where there's delta X, delta Y, okay? Any questions? I don't know if that's clear or not. Seeing no, but shaking hands and saying no. Okay?
So let's look at it. Let's maybe take another example to be precise. I'm giving you, let's say that this is my rectangle. Maybe it starts at 0, 0, and it goes to 5, 4. 5, 4, 5, 5. And maybe I'll have a tree, a line of trees that goes from 1, 1, a line of trees that goes 4 units that way. Maybe I've got a set of trees here, a box of trees. That goes like this. And my problem is, given this, try to find the largest area empty rectangle that I can find. Okay? Any questions? Any ideas about properties that that rectangle might have?
Trees will be on the edge of it.
There's got to be something on the edge of it. Okay? What might be on the edges of the rectangle?
A border of the area that.
The border could be something, and a tree is something. Does there have to be something blocking every single edge of the optimal rectangle?
Sure seems like it. Otherwise, you could have a bigger rectangle.
Right. So somehow, if I did that, I thought it would be blocking these three sides, but not that side, I would keep growing this until it blocked. by one is the largest gram area rectangle, right? So somehow one way to think about this might be to think about what are the set of constraints. What are the possible rectangles of interest? Okay? Any questions? Okay? Again, maybe we'll talk about this one after we get a little bit into the theory of things.
Okay? Any questions about that? The next one is a description of the game Hotter Colder.
Okay, I don't know if you played this when you were a child. Okay? But basically it says you're in a square room, you know, you're in a room that is, let's say, 10 by 10. Okay? You're originally here. Okay, and you're playing against somebody who knows where the buried treasure is. Okay? Or buried treasure, whatever they want to say. So you're trying to find a particular point. You go to another point in the room, let's say over here, and you now ask the person you're playing against, am I hotter or am I colder? Am I closer to where the buried treasure is? Or am I further? Closer is hotter. Colder is further. Suppose I get over to here and tell you that I am colder. Where might the treasure be? Take a look. I have a square room here. I start out at this point. I walk across to the other side, and I now find that I'm colder than I was. Where might the buried treasure be? What? What's the other direction? And where are the possible locations for the treasure?
And that room is the whole area?
Yeah, the room is, you know, it's in the room.
So, it's definitely where you are now.
But here's where I was. This is at time t0. Now I'm here at time t1.
Divide the room in half diagonally. It's in the lower left-hand half.
You want to claim that it is here. Why is that? How do we know that?
Because we basically have a mirror image on each side. Each half represents the same amount of area, the same shape of area. This is a square, I assume.
Yeah, okay, it's quite a square.
So if it wasn't in that area, it would actually be closer to the second point than the first point.
Right, so these are the set of points. Another way to think about it is that these are the set of points that are closer to this than they are to this.
If it was the same, the point would have to be on the hot line, correct?
If it was the same, it was not hotter and colder, but, you know, what do they tell you if it's the same? Can they answer
it's
either?
Same. Yeah, same.
Oh, same. Then they know it's on the line. Okay.
So it's not only hotter and colder, but it could be same. If it's same, then you know that it's on that. Okay? And now what happens? Now what might be a good place to go for your next point? Let's say that for my next point I go over here. Hotter, colder. And now I'm told that I'm hotter. What do I now know about where the treasure is?
The half of the shaded triangle closest to it.
So you want to say the half? Which half? This half?
The half of the shaded side.
So you want me to go like this?
No. Or the triangle.
You want to say that it's this part?
That part that's closest to where you are right now.
So if I'm hotter, you want to tell me it's this triangle.
Right.
Is that true?
No.
Could it? No, why not?
If it was on the center point, then it would be the same.
If it was on the center point, it would be the same. What about here? Is this hotter to here than it is to there? Suppose I said hotter.
I think it's divided down the middle.
Well, is this point closer to here or closer to there?
Yeah, closer to TT than T1.
Okay.
seems like the division line is always going to be perpendicular to the line that connects the two points.
Okay, does that make sense? Let's think about that. Suppose I give you 2 points here. Suppose, let's say that, here we have, want to divide the world up equally into points that are from here. How would we do that division? One idea was to say, suppose we took the perpendicular bisector to this. Okay, so this is 90 degrees. Bisector means that the distance here is the same as the distance there. Why is the bisector important?
Because we want to know the distance to the object.
Right.
And if we move from one location to the other,
right, okay, right. So if we push the line closer to here,
right,
then we're not dividing it. Basically, we want to know which set of points are closer to this than to that. Okay. How do we know that any other point is going to be on that side of the line? Okay.
I don't know if they prove this or not.
I don't pretend to understand that diagram. What are you trying to do when what are you bisecting?
What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to bisect the world. Okay? You and I are going to divide the world between us. Okay? We want to divide it equally. I would actually like more of it than you, frankly, but you just agree. So we're going to have to divide it equally. Okay? What is the way that we can divide it equally so that, we both have the same, that we divide the world into where all points that are closer to me than you are part of my world, and all parts that are closer to you than me are part of your world. Okay? Yeah.
So, okay, the way I was going to say is that by definition, if we take a line from this point that's parallel to this line, we're going to end up with right angles.
Yeah.
And so, because this line is defined, if this and this are equal, we know that this distance is greater than this distance.
Okay.
We also know that this distance for these two triangles is the same.
Okay.
So, Pythagorean theorem tells us that this line has got to be shorter than this line.
That's actually a good nice little proof. Can everybody sort of see what's happening? So, he's saying somehow, well, look, this is the line between the two points. Any point, other point, this is our perpendicular bisector. Okay, why is that the interesting point? Why do we know that every point is going to get assigned, is going to be closer to the point on that defines inside of the perpendicular bisector than the other one? Well, Pythagorean theorem. We have this line between us. We know that the perpendicular bisector divided that into half and half. Any other point, the closest point of that to that line, is going to be straight, a perpendicular line to it. That's something I think we showed, or at least, I think that's pretty clear. This is a right triangle. So what is the interesting point? The distance from here is this squared plus this squared. Let's take the square root of it. The distance from here to there is this squared plus this squared, take the square root of it. This is the same in both of them. So the distance is going to be governed by this versus this. This is clearly bigger than that. Okay? Therefore, somehow it's the perpendicular bisector that tells you something about where, what side of the point line the points are on. Okay? So what is this hotter, colder problem basically going to be? You're going to maintain the region that is of all the is the correct size of all the points you have seen so far. And then I think it asks you for the area of this region.
Right? Okay. And basically, so basically you've got to maintain this polygon of possible, this region of possible locations, and compute the area of that.
Any questions? Okay. So the real question is going to be, how do we do things with polygons?
Okay. And like, what kind of things? We have to compute areas of polygons. What other things do we have to do with these polygons?
I've got to find the length of the perimeter of a polygon.
Which is relatively easy, but actually just finding the polygon in the first place, like for the frosh, is maybe not so easy.
Okay, so I have to find this polygon and maintain it somehow. Okay? So we'll think a little bit more about that when we talk a little bit more about polygons. Any questions? You have to be able to somehow update the polygon. Is it adding or subtracting? So you're saying that you're basically, it's always subtracting, right? The more hotter, more information you have, the region shrinks, right? So basically you have to know how to chop things off of the polygon. Okay, that seems to be the issue that you're worrying about. Okay? Any questions? Okay?
Finally, one other one. The last one is this problem that I find kind of somehow very amusing. I don't know why. But it somehow says that, you know, there's this boy who wants to dip his bread into milk.
Okay, if you have a polygonal piece of bread, and you've got a milk dish, and the milk dish has a certain thickness of milk in it. And if you want to make the milk wet, you know, make the bread wet with milk, what you can do is you can tilt the side of the bread down and dip it in the pan. And then this part of the bread gets milk wet. Okay, does everybody sort of see what the scenario is? You've got this pool, the pan is big enough that it's wide enough that it can support the entire thick length of the polygon. Presumably it's a very long and thin pan, that's the problem. This little pool is only thick enough to accommodate a slice of bread. Okay? But you're allowed to wet it by dipping the polygon into the bread. The polygon bread into the milk. Okay? And this child wants to solve the following problem. He knows that he basically is allowed to dip the bread into the milk k times. How can he maximize the amount of wet bread he gets, given that he dips it in only k times? Okay? You figure out, okay. So, any questions about what the problem is? Suppose I give you one polygon. Let's say I'm only going to dip it one time. Suppose I give a polygon here. How might you figure out what is the wet area for dipping it one time? Okay. What is
longest
sort of the
side? Longest side, maybe?
Is it the longest side that will do that?
It should be whatever it is.
Area. Now,
it's not always the longest side.
Yeah. So first of all, let's think about what it would be. First question, if the polygon is not convex, I claim that it's not necessarily the longest side. An example would be if our bread was very thin, long side. Like the fat region here. Okay? It might very well be that if you dip this thing into a height of t, you might get more than if you dip this into a height of t. Does everybody agree with that? But is the polygon here convex to start with?
Yes.
Okay, so that isn't really relevant. So one question is
it the largest leg? And that might be reasonable. Okay, let's stop and think about that though. Okay, is it? Let's think of going to the proof for an argument.
I had something that looked like this. I had it nice.
Slightly nested edges. I'm not sure whether I believe this or not. Okay? But suppose, let's say I had a point. I want to know if I have a sharp point. And then further on, a skinny point. Okay? A skinny point defined by a lot of littler edges, let's say. But if I wait long enough, because these things can, if I wait long enough, it's going to diverge to a fat thing. I don't know offhand whether it may or may not be. Okay, I'm not sure I believe this yet. Okay? That's not a counterexample. That's not a proof that it can't be done. But that's something that tells me that this needs a proof. But I don't yet completely believe that. I mean, that the biggest edge necessarily is the one that gives you the most area. Okay? Certainly, but we can suppose, let's put it as follows. Suppose every edge has the same area, the same length. Because there may be another counterexample. Suppose every edge had the same length. Is it clear that under those conditions that doesn't make any difference which edge you hit? Let's think about that. That'd be another counterexample to that. It's true. Suppose let's say I have
Yeah, it's definitely, doesn't work.
Why does it work?
You create a house-shaped polygon where this side, maybe these are right angles, we'll define them here. Then, whatever you're giving one of these, obvious this is some area, which is going to be the exact same area as this. This is square.
Oh, okay, very good.
Plus, yes. This is extra.
Okay. Does everybody see that? This is a good example here. Okay? That here, again, this area here is going to be less than this. And it will be true even if I made this tiny bit bigger than this edge, right? That I could get away even if this was sort of 1, and this was 1 plus epsilon, where epsilon was very, very small. It's not necessarily the case that the largest edge does the largest amount of area, right? Okay? So this is a little trickier than just that. Any questions? Okay? So these are sort of the problems. These may sound complicated, but three of these, 1, 2, 3, have to do clearly with polygons. The other one has to do with rectangles, which are sort of, rectangles are polygons, but they're special enough polygons you may not need the whole machinery for dealing with polygons to deal with that. But so what I'd like to now talk about are, now that we have any questions about these problems, these grossly what the problems are, let's talk a little bit about some computational geometry, and then we can maybe get back into the details of the problems and see which are most accessible, which are not. Any questions? Okay. So what is this story?
First of all, when I want to represent shapes, I mean, there's a couple of different ways. How do you represent shapes in a computer? Okay. You can represent, obviously we talked about circles last time. Representing shapes by sort of curves and certain, you know, sort of curves like parabolas and ellipses and things like that turn out to be complicated because you have a lot of numerical issues. So the easiest way to represent shapes in general is as ordered collections of line segments, okay, which is what we would call a polygon, okay? So a line segment, we talked about lines last time. A line segment, remember, a line is the set of, you know, is basically defined by any two points. A line segment is defined also by two points, where we simply throw away the part of the line that goes to infinity beyond that 2 point. So a line segment is defined as the portion of the line between 2 points. Any questions about that? That should be fairly simple. So the way that we will describe a polygon, okay, is going to be as an ordered collection of line segments. Okay? A polygon, because it's closed, a polygon is going to be a set of line segments that closes on itself. The interesting thing about the polygon is going to be that it is sort of the boundary is ordered. You can walk around the boundary of a polygon. Okay, it's not just a set of line segments, but an ordered set of line segments. Any questions? How might you represent a polygon? Could someone give me a concise representation for how you might store a polygon? Yeah?
Array of points.
An array of points. Now, why is it an array of points and not an array of line segments?
Two adjacent sides will share one common point.
That's exactly right. So somehow the interesting thing here is that if we store, represent a polygon as an array of points, the segments between them are implied. Okay, that's, I guess, the difference. Okay, is that if we describe this as P1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the segment between 1 and 2 is sort of like this. So how would we find all the edges in a polygon? Let's say we wanted to compute the perimeter of a polygon described by n such points, P1 through Pn. The perimeter is the length of the region around it. That's the amount of silk that that our frost tire is going to care about. How do you compute the perimeter? Yeah.
Find the distance between two adjacent points.
The distance between two adjacent points.
Like, for example, find a distance between point A and B, distance between B and C, C and D, so on until you get back to where you started from.
Okay? So it's something like 4i goes from 1 to to 1 to n. Compute the distance from point I to point I plus 1. Okay?
Special case
when you get to the end, yeah.
Special case is when you get to the end.
But then it'll be A to n to A to 1.
How can we get around the special case without actually writing? How can we write the loop to compute the perimeter of this? Okay, without the special case.
Just duplicate the point.
Do not.
Well, one way, okay, two very good solutions here. One possibility is we could just say put P1 down here again. Okay, and now we just go from 1 to n, even though we've got n plus 1 points in the array. That might be one way to do it. The other way is that basically we compute the distance from Pi to Pi plus 1 mod n. Okay? And then for the special case where I equals n, n plus 1 mod n is 1. Right? This is much better than writing a separate special case at the end to sort of add up that last statement. Any questions about that? Okay. So the secret to making geometric programs work reasonably is eliminating special cases. Because every time you have a special code in there, it's an opportunity for you to make a bug. Okay. And these bugs, it's very hard to debug these things. Okay. So, any questions?
Yeah.
So this is a nice little trick. Now, how did I represent? Well, a segment I have represented as P, 2 points, P1 and P2, okay?
What kind of operations do you want to do on line segments?
Let's think about it. What kind of operations might you want to do on a line segment? If you wanted to generalize those kinds of
intersections between two line segments?
Intersections between two line segments, okay? Given two line segments, we might want to tell, do they intersect, okay? Or if they intersect, where do they intersect, okay? What are the cases where two line segments might intersect? Okay, the obvious question, given two line segments drawn on the board, the question of do they intersect is pretty easy to resolve, okay? But now let's try to look at the question of given two line segments, okay, stored in the computer described by P1 and P2, P3 and P4. How do we test whether they intersect? What are the special cases that we have to worry about? How many ways can two side segments intersect?
They intersect, they can actually intersect once, or if they're same lines, or if they superimpose on one another.
One possibility is they intersect at one point. One possibility is they intersect at all the points of a line segment. Another possibility is that they intersect each other, okay, partially, on more than one point, but not completely. Is there any other case?
They don't intersect at all.
Depending on how
we implement it, I'm not sure if that would be, but they could intersect at the same point.
Exactly, they could intersect at an end point.
Right.
Oh.
Okay. So depending upon how they, do these two line segments intersect? Well, probably depends upon what you count as an intersection, right? Okay. Somehow, you've got to deal, wrestle with that question. Okay. And actually.
It'll be interesting for us to tell whether my program does or does, how does my point handle that, okay?
So those are the possible cases. How might you go and do the computation? Let's think about this. How might you go and tell whether to test whether two line segments intersect? This is sort of the basic primitive that people use, for a lot of geometric problems, okay, that we're going to use, okay? First of all, what's the time complexity of this operation in big O terms? Two line segments, what's the time complexity of testing whether they intersect? Okay. Well, how much input is there an N involved anywhere? Okay? There's no end, 2 points, right? Two line segments, 4 points. Okay? So the first observation is, and this may be maybe not a fair question, the time complexity to intersect two line segments had better be constant, right? You shouldn't be having a loop in this program, should you? There's nothing to loop over. Okay? But how might you tell whether or not what the line, the compute test whether two side segments intersect? Talked about intersection at all so far. How you compute any? What geometric objects do we know how to find whether they intersect?
Lines.
Lines. So does line, how might line intersection help us with line segment intersection?
Yeah. In the case where they're parallel, they're not the same.
If it's parallel,
if
the lines are parallel, and they don't, if they're parallel and they have different and they're not identical lines, then they do not intersect. That's certainly true. If the lines are parallel, though, what do we do? That's actually a special case now. That actually might be a way to handle some of the special cases. How many of these special cases are caused by parallel lines? Well, I think this case and this case, right? So parallel lines are not an uninteresting special case. How might we tell whether or not it's tested? So now you're doing two parallel lines. Two line segments defined by parallel. Let's say these are exactly the same line. Okay, so they do intersect. How would you determine when they intersect? So, I mean, you have two, the same lines, my segments might intersect, not intersect, or they might intersect. How might I tell that?
They have the same slope. And you know they're parallel.
If they have the same intercepts, we know they're identical. Okay, so that we know from last time, we can tell whether the lines are identical. How might we tell whether or not the segments intersect?
I would argue that if they intersect, this one slope of one segment is positive, the other one has to be negative.
Well, no, we're dealing with special case of parallel lines. Oh, the slopes are the same, the lines are. If the slopes are the same and the intercepts are different, there's no chance. The slopes are the same and the intercepts are the same. They may or they may not. How might we separate those two cases apart?
If they have the same slope, then one of them better have an x coordinate that's between or equal to the range the other one covers. This one's going to have an x-coordinate of, this one's got x1, and this is x2. Well, this point better be between x1.
If they are on the same line, the real question, if this is x1, x2, for a particular line 1, the question really is, are the x-coordinates, if they do overlap, then one of the endpoints of this segment is going to have to be the x coordinate of one of the x segments of one of the endpoints of this segment are going to have to be between that and the other one. Everybody agree with that? So by testing that gives us a way to settle the parallel line case.
How would you test that for that?
How would we test for that? Okay, I think it's basically a question of testing x indices. We'll see how I did it in a few minutes, but we'll. But I think that basically what I would be wanting to know is L1 X1 between L2 X1 and L2 X2? If it is, then they intersect. Okay? And I have repeated this thing probably four times for each of the four cases. Okay? Just to make sure you know, they could be overlapping here, they could be overlapping down there. Which one is L1, which one is L2? Is unclear. One might contain the other. We have to be careful. We work through all those cases. Okay? Any questions? Suppose that's not true. Now they're not parallel lines. How might we tell whether or not two line segments intersect if they're not parallel lines?
Seems like the generalization of what we were just talking about, where the endpoint of one is between the endpoints of the other, has to be the case that some line has its endpoints, has at least one endpoint between the points of the other line.
Can I say that again?
I guess what I'm trying to say is that if you have any two lines that intersect, like say if we have a line here and I want to find out if some other line intersects with it, and I take the x-coordinates, and I have another line. Either the one endpoint for the other line better be within this range, or the endpoints for this line better be within the range of the endpoints for the other one. Because if neither one overlaps, then it must be the case that they're like this. You know, they have to be off the side of them. Otherwise, there has to be some kind of overlap.
What about this kind of situation? I don't know if I believe that so much. What about this? So is that the second?
No. So what I'm saying is you can eliminate, but that's, I think, the same thing in, let's see, we can't eliminate from the net.
I don't think that's what you want. I don't think that you want to do
what you want. I think we can use it to eliminate lines from intersection, but I don't think there's anybody to find out what they're using this day.
What might be some way to do it? Any ideas how to do this? Okay? I think there's several different approaches that might work. Okay? One possibility is, suppose we know that these two lines are not parallel. We've already talked about that. What do we know how to do so far? Do we know how to find the point of intersection of those lines? So given, suppose they were not line segments, but they were lines. I claim we could find the point of intersection.
And then see if that point is on one of the line segments.
Okay? So one way to do it is to tell whether or not that point of intersection is on the line segment.
If it's on both line segments.
On both line segments, right? And how do we do this? Now I think your X game might do the job, right? That's how we did it before. Once we know that this point is on this line segment, okay, basically if this point is on, we know that we've got a point that is on the line, is going to be on the line segment if the x coordinate here is between that and that, right? But it's not going to be on the line segment. Okay, now this is no longer, the x coordinate here is not nested within that.
How are you going to determine if that point's on the line segment? I mean, I can do it conceptually, I just don't know how you would do it program wise.
Well, I would take the two points and have them define a line. And basically, we're now asking for is the two lines, what is the intersection point of two lines? Okay, which we showed how to do last time, right? So we can do that based on...
Okay, I understand that. I understand if I need an intersection point, but how do you determine if that intersection point is in a line segment?
Well, the way we would do it is, we know that if we have a line, a point on a line, tell me, here's our line. This point is on the line, meaning this point has an x coordinate, of x value. We know that this point, there's an x low and an x high. Okay, if this point is on the line, and we reduce to one to test whether it's on the line segment, if it's on the line segment, it better be between here and here.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, any questions? Everybody see why that works?
Yeah, just clicked. Okay.
Now tell me why it doesn't work. Okay?
Because if you have a vertical line, then...
What happens if we have a vertical line? Okay?
Then you have to test for y.
Okay, then in the vertical line, you're going to have to test for y somehow. Okay, and see how the cases are sort of multiplying and it's potentially getting ugly and dangerous? Okay.
This is why computer graphics is, because I know computer graphics is basically geometry. This is why doing computer graphics can be so hard because you have to deal with all these cases.
Well, it's true that in general, doing any geometric programming, there is a big problem with special cases. Okay? And, you know, this is sort of, I actually got my PhD doing computational geometry. And you know I like to program things. Okay? That said, the reason I eventually left computational geometry was this stuff looked too complicated for me to program. Okay? I never wanted to do this kind of stuff. You know, anything but theory. The theory is very nice, you'll see. But, so, actually, implementing geometric stuff is very complicated. Okay? And we see that one of the sources of the complication is special cases. And so we have to do the moral here is you better be designing special primitives. Isolate your special case stuff to the primitives and work hard to get those primitives right. Okay? So you shouldn't be doing all kinds of ad hoc geometry outside of very special routines. Okay? I think in terms of high level routines. Any questions? Okay? Let's think though of another way to do line segment in this intersection test then. Just a sort of, this is a general educational thing. How can I tell if this line segment intersects? What is a necessary thing for another line segment to intersect this line segment? Be a necessary condition.
Points have to be on opposite sides.
If we take the line and goes through the line segment, what we really want to know is if this line segment is going to intersect that, it better be that one point is to the left of that line segment and one point is to the right. Does everybody agree with that? And, so using this idea, if we could tell whether a point was to the left or to the right of a line segment, how could we use that to test whether two line segments intersect? Okay. Is it enough? Here I've got my line L1. Is it enough that point that P1 be on a different side than P2? The line segments to intersect?
You basically have to do it for both line segments.
Have to do it for both line segments, right? Here we know that yes, P1 and P2 are on different sides of the line defined by that line segment. Does that mean that they necessarily intersect? No, because it could be up here. Okay? But if so, then look what happens. Both of these points are on the same side of the line segment. So in order to do this, we would need to have a way of telling left side from right side. Okay? Any questions? So if I have a point, a routine that given a line segment, okay, given three points, come to think of it, told me is to turn to the left or to the right. That's enough of a primitive to let me tell where the line segments intersect. Does everybody agree with that? Because what do I want to now know? For line segment one, I take the first point. Do I curve to the left or the right to get it? Okay, it better be that those two points I curve in a different way, right? One is to the left, one is to the right. So if I go from here, that's a left turn. Here, that's a right turn.
I don't understand what that's telling you.
Well, if I want to use this test, the test that we were saying now is two lines intersect. If and only if. But the two endpoints of the first line segment lie on different sides of the line defined by the second line, or the first line. And the two endpoints of the first line lie on different sides of the line defined by the second line segment. So if you could solve the following special primitive, given point P1, P2, and B3. Tell me, does this point lie to the left or to the right of that line? Okay? That is really enough then to do the test, right?
Because when you test P3, whatever it is, P4 better be the other
one. P4 better be the other one. Okay, and you really want to now know, is it to the left of this line or to the right of that line? And that would be enough to do that test. Any questions? Okay, so this primitive of telling whether or not you lie to the left or right is very important. Okay, we'll show how to compute that, okay, in a very slick way in a few minutes. Any questions? So how did I implement line segment testing?
My way was the following. Okay? I took my two line segments and converted them to lines. Okay?
If they were the same line, I gave you that routine before, but I was doing geometry, meaning the x, y, and the coordinate, then I know that they overlap. What I did was essentially the x and y testing that you're doing. But what I really wanted to know was something different. I asked, is a point of one in the box of the other? So what was my idea here? Suppose I want to now know now I have two lines that are on the same two line segments that are on the same line. Okay? I want to now know whether or not they overlap. I claim that my test reduces to, is there a line segment, if I take a look at the box defined by one line segment, I really want to know, is there an endpoint of the other line segment that lies in my box, right? So this is actually not the right picture. Here's one line segment, it defines a box. Another line segment will intersect with this, on the same line will intersect it, if and only if there's an endpoint in this box.
But it also still on a diagonal line.
Has to be on the line. That's what I said. It is the same line. Okay? And basically, so long as there exists a box defined by one of the line segments, okay, here's S2. Because that's one, is there a point on the other side that is in that box? If so, then they intersect. Okay? Any questions about that? Then I can test it whether I'm in the box is really saying is the x between the smaller of the two x's and the bigger of the two x's, and y is y between the smaller of the y's and bigger than the y's. Any questions? Okay? Then, if it's not the same line, but they are parallel, then I return false. They can't intersect. Otherwise, I know that there is an intersection point of those two lines, at most, exactly one. I then ask, is that intersection point in the box defined by one segment and the box defined by the other segment? And that, I claim, is the test that we're trying to do. Okay? Any questions about that? So this is enough, I claim, to tell whether or not two segments intersect. Okay, and it works, it covers all the cases. Any questions? What happens, though, if the two line segments share an endpoint? Will this routine decide whether that the line segments intersect or not?
Yes.
Okay.
If you're pointing box, you have a greater than.
Right, so it looks like, basically in this case, I will say that two line segments that share a vertex do intersect.
And if you don't like that, that's probably simple enough to reduce the less than or equal to the greater than or equal to one side of the question. Any questions? Okay?
Very good. Okay, so that's, again, that may not have been that exciting, but I did want to go through this because it shows you the complexities that come up in some of these primitives. And so I recommend that you be careful writing them or steal the code from someplace, okay? But make sure you understand what you steal. Again, my stuff is on the web now if you want it, but test that out. Okay. So the other computation that we're going to want to do is basically testing. Again, we decide polygons, we said, could be represented by arrays of points. So my polygon structure is basically an array of points with an integer telling me what the number of points in my polygon is. And again, I use this mod trick to deal with the edge between the first and last point. Now, we say that we talked about the convex polygons. A convex polygon is a special case of a polygon where there are no notches somehow. Again, this is not a convex polygon because there was a line segment that went between two points in the polygon that left the polygon. How can you test, given a polygon, whether or not it's convex? Yeah? Okay. Every internal angle is less than 180 degrees. Does that do the trick? Okay. It looks like it should do the trick, right? So to test whether an angle polygon is convex, would you really have to be an internal or external angle? The internal angle. This is an okay bend because this angle is less than 180 degrees, right? And this angle is less than 180 degrees. This angle is less than 180 degrees.
I just mentioned our definitions, right? It's convex if its internal angles are less than 180.
So another definition of convex, one that would give you, let's say, a test, is the polygon where all the internal angles are less than 180. What's the word for angle less than 180 degrees? I remember it was cute. Little is cute. My daughter is cute. She's 3 weeks old. So otherwise, things that are not cute are obtuse. Okay, I am sure that's something too. I deal with obtuse people sometimes. They're not cute. So what is the interesting point? To test the property of a convex polygon is that all the angles are less than 190 degrees. 180 degrees, okay, or pi radians, right? How do you compute that angle? Let's think about this now. Can you write a routine that given V1, V2, and V3, computes what this angle is?
Somehow have to know which side of the angle you're computing.
Okay, well, if it goes from P1 to P2 to P3. That's an interesting question. So, you're right. You somehow need to have a convention as to, is the angle that you're interested in the internal angle here or the external angle there? Okay? So that's something you have to keep track of. Okay? And that's a tricky business to keep track of. Okay? So I actually will tell you that it is extremely difficult to write a routine. Doable, presumably. But it's extremely tricky to write a routine that given 3 points. Well, first of all, let's think what should the angle be? Clearly it depends upon, first of all, a convention. What he's really saying is not really a question of tricky or not. He's saying you need to have a convention as to whether you mean the angle that goes around
you know, which way do we actually mean the angle to go? Is it a clockwise angle or a counterclockwise angle? Which way is this? The external thing here. Is that clockwise or counterclockwise?
Counterclockwise.
I think of that as counterclockwise. This is clockwise. So this gets into the first thing. When you give your points in, you want to test whether or not your points are in convex fifth angle, a convex polygon. You need to know somehow, it seems, are the points given in clockwise order or counterclockwise order? Okay, is that clear? This is one of the things that can throw you off. Okay, any questions? Okay, so one of the things that you need to worry about if you're actually computing absolute angles is your, are your polygons being listed, the points being listed in clockwise order or counterclockwise order? Okay? The second thing I'll claim is just the trigonometry here is still somewhat tricky. I always find it tricky. Okay, because you've now got to deal with two cases. What is the angle here? Well, it's going to be pi plus, you sort of, you know, you can't just, how do you compute an angle between points? We're used to doing it with, you know, sort of SOHCAHTOA and that kind of business, right? But that, I don't see where we're getting the right angle from that. Okay? So what I claim is actually computing angles is a very difficult thing to do. To test if the polygon is convex, though, do we need to compute these angles? Or is there something simpler, less demanding that we need to know? Yeah. You need to know the angle, or do you need to know whether it's greater than or equal to pi?
You think that it's greater or equal to pi.
Okay. So in fact, a simpler primitive, okay, is to just tell whether or not, okay, a third point lies to the left or the right of a directed line. Okay. Suppose, let's say, I gave you a primitive that did this, okay? And given two lines, points, one, two, three. What you really want to know is, does point three lie to the left of it on the directed line, or to the right of it? Or is it on it? What does it tell you if the angle is exactly 180 degrees?
Actually, that means that you have a side made up of two segments.
They're three collinear points, which is potentially trouble in certain cases, or potentially interesting to know. What I claim is that a way that you can get, usually, as it turns out, will not care too much about what the actual angle is. An important special case is that angle bigger, greater than or less than 180 degrees? Okay? And so to do that, we'll define a primitive called the counterclockwise test, which tests basically does C lie to the right of the directed line, defined by A and B. Any questions? Okay. Now let us think about it. Is this clockwise? What should counterclockwise be? I always get this confused. And maybe there's not even really a good answer. Suppose from 1 to 2. I guess the counterclockwise test is really a question of whether if we interpret the angle as a counterclockwise angle, is it acute, right? This was a counterclockwise angle, right? And we want to now know, is this going to be, what do you call it? If it's acute, it's going to be considered to be counterclockwise. If not, on the other side, it's not going to be counterclockwise. Any questions? How can we compute that?
The interesting thing is there's actually a very, very easy and slick way to do this. Okay? And it has to do with, in the last chapter,
We talked about this formula for computing the area of a triangle. And I gave you that determinants formula to tell you whether or not the area of a triangle, and the trouble was that it came out as either positive or negative, right? Well, if I remember correct, when did I tell you what governed whether or not it was positive or negative? It defined whether I described my triangle like this or like that. So somehow the sine of my sine angle computation is enough to tell me whether that third point is on the left or the right side. Okay? And so basically, if the sine area is greater than zero, then we say that it's counterclockwise. If it is less than zero, we say it's clockwise. If it's equal to zero, we say the three points are collinear. And this gives me predicates for basically telling me which way the angle is. I find I always get confused between clockwise and counterclockwise. But for most applications, you just need to know that, say, is it different? Given two points, are they different? Do they lie on different sides of the line? Or in the case of testing if a polygon is convex, you need to know, is it always the case they all lie on the same side all the way through?
And if they're all counterclockwise.
Are they all counterclockwise?
Or
it could be if you want to say, or if you wanted your version program to work without knowing if your polygon is clockwise or counterclockwise. But you really want to now know, are they all the same? Right?
Yeah.
And that would enable you to not have to know whether your polygon is convex, is clockwise or counterclockwise. Basically, walk around your polygon, find the sine of the next point, next point, next point, next point. Okay, and you're done. Any questions?
The minute it deviates,
you're in trouble. Okay, any questions? Okay. Thanks for your attention. I see I'm a little bit long. Think about these problems a little bit, and we'll talk more about the geometry next class. Thank you. So, okay, the other question is, was there a problem of the day? What was the problem of the day? Does anybody have the listing? I could miss it. What exactly is the problem of the day? Can someone read it? 124, it says something about here, give a linear time reduction to the problem of finding the maximum element in an array. The sorting. What does this reduction tell us about upper and lower bounds of finding the maximum element in a sequence? And this gets us back to the material on NP completeness. So before I talk about reductions, I'd like to summarize. Last class we started talking about NP completeness. I want to summarize the entire idea about NP completeness. Okay, it's this idea of doing reductions. If you understand this slide, you understand what we will do for the rest of the semester. Okay? More or less. Suppose I give you the following algorithm to solve a problem called the Bandersnatch problem. Insert your name in place of Bandersnatch. Okay? Bandersnatch of G. To solve Bandersnatch of G, we're going to translate the input. Whatever it may be, a graph problem, it may be a sorting problem, in which case we have a list of items. Take the input to G. I convert it into an instance of the Bobilli problem, which may have to be a different, maybe a number problem. It may be a, what other kinds of data might there be? Maybe it's a string problem, I don't know. Okay, but somehow translate the input from this to this in such a way that the answer of Bobilli on the translated input is the same as Bandersnatch on the original input. So it's not that you just translate the input here to some arbitrary instance. Okay? For example, one way to reformat a problem would be, suppose this was a graph problem and this was an integer problem. One possibility is to take any input graph and translate it to the integer zero. Okay? Yes, now it's a number, but you didn't really translate it in a way that preserves the answer. The key idea here is we want to translate the input of G to the input of the input G of both Bandersnatch to an input Y of both Bobilli, such that the answer of Mobilia on Y will be the same as Bandersnatch on G. If we did the translation such that the answers are correct, then if I have a Mobili subroutine, I can call Mobili on Y and solve the problem, okay, and then report the answer of this as the answer to the original. Any questions? Yes.
What if it's easier to do initial translation than a very small translation on the result?
Okay, the answer is sort of, is it possible that you can do something more interesting than return the exact same answer? Okay, maybe it'd be easier to do the translation so that if the answer to here is true, Mobili will be false and then complement it. You could do that without undermining the theory here, but in general, you don't have to do it. Okay, if you do it, if you stick to this plan, this will usually work. Maybe it's a little bit more complicated translation, but usually I don't have to play those games. Although, in principle, there's no reason why you couldn't without change. Yeah, but allow yourself a little bit of work here before you return the answer. Wouldn't change the spirit of the argument. So what's interesting about this subroutine? Okay? Well, first of all, any translation that preserves the correctness is called a reduction. Now, what is interesting about this Bandersnatch algorithm? This is an algorithm to compute Bandersnatch. Well, if Mobili, if there's a fast algorithm for Mobili that runs in p prime n, and the translation takes pn as a function of the original input, then the total time on to return the answer is going to be pn plus p prime n. This is then a pn plus p prime n algorithm. Okay, so if you have a fast way of doing Mobili, I'm just giving you a fast way to do Bandersnatch. On the other hand, suppose I know that there is no fast way to do Bandersnatch. Okay, I have a proof, a rigorous proof that I believe, firm, no questions asked, that Bandersnatch takes at least p prime n to do. Okay, is it possible that Mobili can be done quickly? And I claim the answer is no. Why? Because this algorithm shows me that if Mobili can be done quickly, let's say that Mobili can be done, okay, quickly, the translation can be done quickly, that would imply a fast way to do Bandersnatch, right? But since there's no fast way to do Bandersnatch, this algorithm proves that there's no way fast way to do Mobili. That's the interesting thing, okay? This algorithm proves that this can't be solved quickly. Okay? If this can't be solved quickly. Okay? This is at least as hard as that. That's what this is saying. Any questions? Okay? This is the key idea. This is the entire idea, really, to doing NP completeness proofs. It's showing that one problem is at least as hard as the other. Any questions? Okay, now what is the problem of the day? It says, give a linear reduction of the problem of finding a maximum element to sorting. So let's think of what kind of algorithms we could write. Could we write an algorithm for max element on a sequence S that uses sorting? The answer is basically keep S intact, sort S, return S sub 1. Okay, let's look at what this algorithm does. Okay? Does everybody agree this is the correct algorithm for computing the maximum element? Right? Okay? Now, what? Well, let's assume that they sort in increasing order. Depends on which way the sorting is working, right? I'm assuming the sorting is going from highest to lowest. Okay? So look what this algorithm proves to me. If I told you that maximum element was hard to do, There was no way to take a look at n things and find the maximum in less than exponential time. Could you shorten exponential time? In less than exponential time? Not if you couldn't do this. Okay, but the trouble is we know that you can do this quickly, right? Okay? What I've given you here is an algorithm for maximum elements, right? What's the time complexity of this algorithm? How much time does it take to take the numbers and do nothing with them? All of one. How much time does it take to sort n elements? N log a. How much time does it take to pull off the first element once they're sorted? So what is the time complexity of this algorithm? This is an n log n algorithm for computing the maximum element. Does everybody agree with that? Okay. And so what does the problem now say? Okay. In a linear time reduction, notice the translation to linear time or even faster, constant time. Okay. The problem finding a maximum element to sorting. Okay. What does it tell us about upper and lower bounds? This tells me I can compute a maximum element as fast as I can sort. Doesn't mean I can't do this faster, right? In fact, does everybody agree I could find the maximum element in theta of n time? Okay, that's a faster algorithm. But that doesn't, but this is still a correct algorithm. Okay? Now, is there, okay, so that's basically what I'm asking for here. Now, why can't I reduce the problem? Can I do this backwards? Can I find a way to sort S by translating S to S prime, such as finding the maximum element on S prime, and then return something from here? Okay, this algorithm, I don't see how to make this work, right? Everybody agree with that? Certainly in linear time, I know I can't. Why? Suppose you tell me, yes, you know a way to do this translation in linear time. I know you can't do this translation in linear time. Why?
Because then I'd have
it. Then you'd have a linear time sorting algorithm, right? And we have a lower bound here that says sorting is omega n log n. Therefore, you can't do it in linear time. Any questions? I don't see how to do it at all, but I know I can't do it faster than n log n. Any questions? Okay? That is the idea of a reduction. Okay? Any questions? So it's kind of a neat this NP completeness world. Okay. Okay, I need to see this, right? Okay. So what do we now want to prove here? Okay, so again, let's talk a little bit more about NP completeness. Last class I proved for you that I described the satisfiability problem. The satisfiability, yes. Okay, what does the NP stand for? I will tell you now, provided if you get confused, you just forget everything that I'm saying. Is that okay? Because this is something that people get confused by, okay? There's a technical, okay, the truth is what NP stands for is non-deterministic polynomial. Okay, how many people here took 303? Okay, you talk about non-deterministic sort of machines, NFAs, remember that these were NFAs that could magically guess the way to go through the, there were lots of possible ways to go from the input state to the final state, but magically it picked the right one. That sounds like a definition of non-determinism. Okay, so a non-deterministic automata was one that even though it had lots of choices, somehow magically took the right move at each point. Polynomial means it runs in polynomial time. Okay? A problem is an NP if there was a way that you could guess the solution and prove that you were right in n log in polynomial time. Okay? So a problem we say is polynomial, then P is polynomial if you can solve it in polynomial time. Right? All minimum spanning tree is in P, it's polynomial time. Sorting is in P, it's polynomial time. The problems that are in NP are ones that if I told you the answer, you could convince me that I'm right in polynomial time. Okay? So it seems like usually it's easier to solve a problem if somebody tells you the answer, right? Someone told you the answer on the exam beforehand, but you have done better on the exam. Okay? The answer is yes. Okay? So NP means the problems where they tell you the answer, you prove that they're right, you convince them that they're right. Okay? NP complete means that it's, in fact, as hard as any problem there. Okay? Complete means as hard as any of these things. Okay? So we say a problem is NP complete. What we're really saying is that it's as hard as any problem, which if they told you the answer, you could prove that they were right in polynomial time. And just every problem we've talked about this semester has that property. If I ask you, find a problem in salesman tour of less than 100, and you give me a traveling salesman tour, can you quickly come up with an algorithm to prove that its weight is less than 100? How would you do that? Add up the edges. This plus this plus this. Okay? The knapsack problem. If I told you here, I give you is there a subset of integers that adds up to t? If I give you the subset of integers, could you convince yourself that that adds up to t in polynomial time? Okay. What other NP-complete problems have we looked at? Any other problem we've talked about as being NP-complete? The max cut problem. Is there a cut in the graph greater than 100 edges? I give you a cut here. Could you add up the edges that got cut and ask if that's more than 100 in polynomial time? All of these problems, if I told you the answer, okay, you could convince yourself that I'm right efficiently. Yes?
Is it
the maximum one? I can't. Is it larger than a threshold? The answer is yes. And remember, what I talked about last class,
when we talk about polynomial, these problems, we're only going to be talking about yes-no questions, decision questions, for just exactly this reason. A yes-no question, is there a cut greater than 100? Is a yes-no question, I can prove it's an NP. Something like, find me the largest cut, there's no way I can convince you the answer quickly. Okay? This is the largest cut, says who? Okay? You need a proof somehow, and But for these decision problems, the proof is usually easy. So that's where the NP comes from. Any questions? Okay, yes. Excuse me?
Okay, so I gave you a solution that was O of N times T. And the answer is this polynomial? Looks polynomial, but this number t can be very, very big. And this is now getting into some technical issues I didn't really want to get into, but I'll explain the answer because you promise to forget it if you get confused. Okay? Polynomial, we mean polynomial in the space of the input. Okay, the space it takes to write the problem down. And how many bits does it take to write a number t? Okay? What? Log, right? A logarithmic number of bits, right? So if I want to write the number 10 to the 1 billion, 10 to the 1 million, 10 to the 100, okay, it's shorter. How many bits do I need to do that? Very little, right? That's something like 300 bits or so, right? 400 bits. If I have to write this number out, this is a huge number, right? So you agree that even though t is equal to, it's only a crummy 300 bits to describe this number. And yet, if I ask for this algorithm, any of you have enough memory that you can build a 10 to the 100 size array on your computer? No. Okay, so this is why the polynomial issue is a little bit weird. You can't have too large a number. Okay, so now this knapsack algorithm depends upon the size of the number. Okay, and you can write numbers very briefly. Okay, but here that brief representation doesn't help you. Any questions? Okay, maybe we'll ask these questions again at the end of the unit here, because now you're getting into the philosophy here. And some of these issues are kind of technical if you haven't had enough computation theory. Okay? But the big picture issue of proving that a problem is hard is a straightforward algorithmic kind of thing. Okay? And that's where I think the interesting and practical applications of this stuff is. Given a problem, show me that it's hard. Okay? Any questions? So last class we talked about the satisfiability problem. The satisfiability problem was a problem on binary variables. Okay? You had a set of binary variables, V1 through Vn. You had a bunch of clauses, where each clause was, either a variable V, you had a list of variables, some of which were negated, okay? And the question was, is there a way to set the variables here true and false, such that every one of my clauses had at least one true literal here? Okay? So you notice that in order to make, let's say that this was, the clause just had not V7. That meant that V7 had to be false. So I was going to satisfy this clause, I needed V7 to be false. Satisfiability said, is there a way to set, given a bunch of, a bunch of or formula, this is if each clause was this or this or this or this, is there a way to set the variables such that all the clauses are true? Or equivalently, if we think of the logic formula, C1 and C2 and C3 ... CM, where each one of these is V1 or V2 ... is there a way to set the thing to make it true? That is satisfiability. Okay? So, any questions? Okay? So, you may think you have this logic formula of describing what is legal. You're an Enron executive. You may want to find a way to set these variables, true and false. Is there a way to make what I did legal? Okay? An interpretation where that's done. That is satisfiability. And it's a hard thing to do in that case. Any questions? Okay? So satisfiability is the logic problem. Free satisfiability is a special case of the logic problem where each clause has exactly three elements in it. V1 or not V4 or, this is or, I guess. Or not V7, V8. Okay, is it, and the question for free set, can we prove that 3-sat is every bit as hard as regular sat? Okay, I convinced you last time satisfiability is hard, requires exponential time as far as we're concerned. Okay? Is 3-sat hard? In order to do it, to show that, I need a translation. How do I have to translate it? Where does my reduction go? I want to show that 3-sat is hard. Given satisfiability is hard. What is the direct, what is Bandersnatch and what is Mobili? Okay, what am I saying here? I want to come up with a, okay, which way is it? Which one's Bandersnatch? Sat, well let's think about that. Sat, 3 sets, you sat on my inputs. Let's call this thing X. Convert X to X prime. Do 3-sat of X prime. Return this. I know that this problem is exponential, right? This problem is hard. If I can show you a way to translate sat to a sat instance to a 3-sat instance, such that the answer stays the same. That's a proof you can't compute 3-sat quickly, right? If you could compute 3-sat quickly, How do you solve general set? Translate it and solve it. Right? Any questions now about the strategy? Yes. But translation has to be less than, has to be polynomial time. Okay? If I take my translation is exponential time, then it does me no good, right? I might as well solve the original thing. But if my translation is n to the 100th, I win. Okay? In fact, it's not going to be n to the 100th. It's going to be n squared, n cubed, something like that. But I've got that much slop to play around with. Any questions? Okay? So how am I going to do this? I'm going to do my translation on a clause-by-clause basis. Okay? If you give me a clause with one element, I am going to, let's say, the clause Z1, I'm going to construct four clauses, okay, for my new solution, for my new problem instance, for X prime. I'm going to replace this one clause from X with these four clauses from X prime. Z all have Z1. These are two new variables I'm never going to use again. But I have all four possible truth assignments. Is there any way I can make all four of these formulas true without Z1 being true? No. If Z1 is false, this part of the equation evaporates. I've got all four possibilities. To make this one true, I need at least one of them true, right? If both of them are true, then this is not going to work, right? Okay? Then not true, not true, then this wouldn't work. If one of them was true, the appropriate complement of the other would not be true, right? Does everybody sort of see that? Any questions about this? So, in fact, there is no way to satisfy all of these. If Z1 was false, if Z1 is true, is there a way to satisfy all of them? Well, why? They're all satisfied automatically, right? You don't care what you do with those variables. Okay, any questions? What if you gave me something, a clause with size 2? Two literals in it. I can translate it by constructing two new clauses. Okay, I'm going to add one new variable, V1 and not V1. If at least one of these guys were true, since they appear in both of those, both clauses will be true. If both of these were false, is there a way that I can satisfy both of them with that extra V1? No. Okay? The satisfiability of this thing is exactly equal to the satisfiability of the other things. Any questions?
If I have a clause of size 3, how do I make it into a clause of size 3 such that the answer is the same? Well, just copy it, right? That's an easy one to translate.
So now, what is the interesting case? The interesting case is, how can I break up a large clause into smaller clauses such that all the variables, that then the whole thing stays true? Right? Suppose I have my formula V1, V2, V3, V4. Is there a way I can make that into clauses of size 3 such that the truth is preserved? If this is satisfiable, if at least one of those guys is true, all the three clauses I build will be done. Does anyone want to propose a translation? Let's think about this. How can I make this into clauses of size 3? Okay? Something I can do is just delete this. But is that going to preserve correctness? Now I've got clauses of size 3. But is that going to preserve correctness? No, what if the truth was there, right? And I've lost it. Okay. Yes. V1, V2, V3. V and V bar, V4. Not going to work, they're both of size 3. But are the truth, this is always going to be true, right? So the only way to satisfy this is to insist that one of these 3 be true, right? That's a stronger condition than this, right? Because if this was false, 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 true, yours would be wrong. Yours would not be satisfiable, even though the original was satisfiable. Okay, yeah.
You make two variables, like A1 equals V1 or
V2. Okay. Let's say no. I'm not allowed to do that. Okay. I'm not allowed to add some auxiliary logic here. Okay? But what I can do is the following. Do you have an idea yet? What's yours? V1, V2, V3. V1, V2, V4. Okay, let's think about this now. Okay? Is it true that both of these can be solved? Is this and this equivalent to this? No, why not? False, false, true, false. Right? Then this would all be false. This would be true. Can everybody see that that doesn't do the muster? Let's try one more, yes. It's possible I could do sets on subsets, but, okay, first of all, it's going to be dangerous when I talk about a clause that has n terms in it, right? Because now you talk about all subsets, you may be talking about something exponential. Okay, let me show you the way that I would do it. Okay? I don't quite see the detail. It may or may not be something similar to what you're saying. What if I do V1, V2, X? X prime, V3, V4. Let's look at this. Is there any way that if all 4 were false, it was not satisfied? Can this be satisfied? No. No, right? These are all false, false. To say that I'll make X true, but now I'm in trouble down here, right? I can't save it in both places. Can I? No. Okay? Now suppose one of these variables is true. Let's say V3 was true. This is true, false, false, false. How do I set X? X has to be true to save this, right? So long as I have at least one true in here, I claim I can save it. Does everybody sort of see that? If I need two of these clauses, the moment I said that one of the honest variables is true, then this clause is taken care of. I don't care about this anymore. I can use my free variable to the benefit of the other clause. Okay, does everybody agree with that? What if my original truth setting was true, 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 true? What value do I set X to? Doesn't matter, right? But see how this does the job? This will preserve the correctness here. The resulting set of formulas can be satisfied if and only if the original one is satisfied. Yes?
But then you have to think X-ray arbitrarily.
Well, remember what you're doing now. You have an algorithm here to solve 3 sets, right? Let the algorithm do it, okay? I'm not actually picking it, okay? Let's think about it. I'm just translating it, feeding it to your algorithm here. Let it solve it, okay? Now, if it solves it, in the course of solving it, it's going to have to go back and figure out what the X's were, right? As well as the B's. But big deal, it knew how to solve these things already, supposedly. So what am I going to do? You give me the solution here. I'm now going to read off, I'll forget what you did with the x's, because I don't care. Once you've satisfied this thing, I'm simply going to take a look at what you gave these v variables. And that's what I will report as the answer to this. Any questions? Does that answer your question or no?
Yes, I do.
Okay, what's the next question?
What if you have any more pizza?
What if I have, this is a clause of size 4, I can translate it like that. What if I have a clause of size 5? How can I translate a clause of 5 elements? Okay. What if I do the following trick? V1, V2, X1. Not X1, X2, V3, X2. Not X2, V4, V5. This is kind of clever. Okay, let's look at this. Okay? Suppose, let's say, V1 is true and only V1 is true. What do I need? Can I set X1? Can I satisfy all of these guys? Well, this one over here, this is going to be false, false, right? So what's X2 going to have to be? X2's going to have to be false, meaning not X2 is going to have to be true, right? That's going to make this false, false. What is this going to be? You have to set that to be not X1 is going to be false, meaning X1 is going to be true. No, not X1's going to be true, meaning X1's going to be false. Here now, this is forced, false, false, but I had that true there to begin with, right? So there's a way to get the job done. This construction is very clever. What if only V1 and V2? This is the only one that's true. Can I satisfy everybody else? Yeah, because I'll simply set this guy. I don't care about it. I can ripple my truths down to satisfy everything below it and everything above it, right? Everybody see that? So basically, if you give me a formula with something where I've got k elements in it, I'm going to construct k minus 2 clauses, okay? By bringing it up where I have two variables, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1 in the middle. And that, I claim, is now a complete reduction from 3-sat to the regular one. Any questions about that? Okay. Now, why won't this work? I know it's a little bit over. The last question. Why won't this work for proving 2-satisfiability? It's hard. Okay. What happens if I try to do this trick on 2-satisfiability? Yeah? Well, but what happens with this construction? That means I squeeze this guy out, right? I now have clauses with no meat in them. I need the 2 to go left and right, right? So in fact, there isn't room to sort of do this kind of a trick. Okay? That's not a proof that 2 satisfiability is easy, but it's a proof that this translation idea won't work. Okay? Any questions? So think about this example. It's in the book. Think about this particular proof. Make sure you understand it, and we'll talk about things next class. Thank you. Thank you.